The original ad man, the queen of luxury, Popeye, and the New York Times. That may sound like an unlikely bunch, but gather them all together and you'll find one hectic year in print media. We're looking back at what made 2016 on the page, today on The Stack. On today's show, the founding editor of the FT's How to Spend It magazine, Lucia Vanderpost.
There's something about its size, which is sort of fat and generous, so you know it's going to be beautifully illustrated. Then immediately I can see that it has a sort of cultural heft, which is appealing to me. I want people to flatter me and think, does my brain look big in this? I think my brain looks big in this.
Plus, the original ad man, George Lois, recalls his favourite Esquire covers and his time working for Robert Kennedy.
I was always more excited about artwork and design that sold, a cause and effect kind of communications. I don't really call myself a designer, I call myself a mass communicator.
All that plus some of our other standout features from throughout the year coming up on this special edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis program. Hello and welcome to The Stack. I'm Ben Rylan. It's been quite a year, to put it mildly. And like just about every industry, publishing certainly felt the effects of 2016, sometimes with quite a thud. But it was also a year that saw even more interesting new titles landing on newsstand shelves. We're spending today's program looking back at some of the most fascinating people we spoke to from throughout the year. Lucia Vanderpost was the founding editor of How to Spend It magazine and once cast a careful eye over the luxury pages of the Financial Times as the international newspaper's lifestyle editor. She's also the author of several books, all espousing the many pleasures of a luxurious lifestyle. Earlier this year, she joined Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulet to discuss the recently relaunched Holiday magazine.
Well, I had no idea that it had been reissued. I think, as I told you years ago, my father used to write for it, and he would get 25, 30,000 words to write a really highly researched and beautifully written essay on Russia, I remember, was one, Japan was another. And it went out of business. I know my father was very sad. And so I had no idea it had been reissued. And I mean, I don't know it. I just looked at it and I thought, that's something I want to look at. There's something about its size, which is sort of fat and generous. So you know it's going to be beautifully illustrated. Then immediately I can see that it has a sort of cultural heft, which is appealing to me. I want people to flatter me and think, does my brain look big in this? I think my brain looks big in this. It's got beautiful photography. I can immediately see there are things I don't know about. It's going to tell me stuff I don't know. That's one of my criterion about
But isn't that odd, though? I mean, when you talk about youth, or just talk about the state of the market in general, you know, so many people do want to focus group a magazine, and there's that sense of sort of safety in numbers as opposed to challenging people.
Yes, I don't think enough magazines challenge people. I think some seduce you with the beauty of their pictures. I mean, I think most of them are very professionally done. I see you've got in front of you, for instance, World of Interiors. That's always a delight visually. I mean, it's a slightly old-fashioned aesthetic usually, but it's beautifully done.
But talking to Jonathan Newhouse, which is, you know, it's very interesting. I love this fact. I had breakfast with him a few weeks ago, and, you know, he said, you know, it's the funny thing about this magazine, Tyler, is that, you know, World of Interiors barely has a digital presence, makes a lot of money.
That is very interesting.
Right?
But of course, what it does isn't amenable to the digital space, is it?
But, yeah,
it does
but
something different.
Yes, but someone could look at it and say, oh, well, we could take all of look, we've got a spread open here about runners on a staircase. Oh, you know, we could animate that and we could do something. You know, but yes, you could
do
that.
It's not how you want to look at
this. No, and also you'd run up a massive bill in an edit suite and to photograph and to make it happen. But no, I agree. I mean, you want to, you know, it's a title you want to just pour over the pages. And I'm right now I'm looking at, this is the February edition. And, you know, just again, I mean, this wonderful, feels like a rather sort of sophisticated gypsy cabin, but, you know, city as canvas, the graffiti artist painting Rome red, yellow and blue. And then, and then, of course, all the things, how Tudors, Georgians and Victorians shaped a Dorset estate. I want to know, or at least if I don't want to read it, I just want to get lost in the pictures.
The thing about World of Interiors, it has a niche. It's doing something that no other magazine that I know does. And that's the hard thing, is to find something that's your own. It has a persona. When you say World of Interiors, something strong, a persona, something comes to mind.
Absolutely.
And that's not true of every magazine. I mean, there are lots I could name where I can't think what they're there for.
No.
You know what that's there for.
Absolutely. Well, at least two recommendations for the weekend.
And then there's Tatler, I see, which I think is like sort of your naughty box of chocolates. It's a sort of a lot of fun, which is another role for luxury, I think.
Absolutely.
You know, I read it last night in bed. I went to bed at about sort of 11:30. We'd just been to see Les Liaisons Dangereuses. And I came back and I thought, oh, goody, goody, goody. Yeah. This will be fun.
Yes. And where would you still find a headline? Fast Sloanes and Lycra, the heady danger of the Cresta Run.
Yeah.
Lucia Vanderpost with Monocle's Tyler Brulé. Now, if you were to create a mood board of everything that's come to epitomise the overall brand of the 1960s, you may well be looking at a picture of George Lois. His work for Esquire magazine resulted in a series of iconic covers that helped make the magazine a lasting pop culture reference. But he's also made his mark in the world of politics. As part of the team behind Robert Kennedy's political career, he played a key role in shaping the public perception of the man behind the name. George popped into our New York bureau for a chat with Monocle's Tom Edwards.
I don't strategize. I don't think about the unique selling proposition. I don't think about your positioning. I don't think about any of that. What I do is I talk to a client or a prospective client. I don't particularly want to hear their research. I don't particularly want to hear their market research. And I certainly don't want to hear a strict strategy they want to take place. Because I could go far above and beyond that power by going straight to find the big idea. And once I get that big idea, an idea that stuns, then I can take a look at what I did, and I put down 10 versions of a print ads, I'll put down 3 or 4 commercials, I'll put down promotion ideas. And once I take a look at what I did, I can pull a strategy out of it and tell that client that that was my strategy. And it's not, I'm not kidding anybody, it turns out to be a strategy that when you describe the strategy to them, they say at the beginning of a presentation, they say, my God, that's thrilling, but how could you possibly achieve that in an ad campaign? And I would show them my ad campaign. Mm. My strategy always came out of my big idea, because the big idea was intuitive, it was powerful, and I knew it would be so memorable that it would make I could make $1 million look like $20 million.
And I'm sure once you made that look that way, people were a lot more relaxed, George, I'm sure. If we can just jump forwards a bit, George, I want to ask you just about some of your most celebrated work. You mentioned at the top the iconic works from your career, and I guess many people will look to the MoMA retrospective, which featured almost 40 of your incredible Esquire covers. Tell us a little bit about what the Esquire covers came to mean to you. Such a kind of lauded and long career. What place do those now, such famous images, what place do they occupy for you?
Many people still think that I was the art director at Esquire magazine. I started my ad agency in 1960. It was a great success. It was the beginning of the creative revolution. Then the editor of the magazine, Harold Hayes, who was fighting it out with a few other editors to get the top job, was watching my career, reading about me in the Times and all the and magazines all over America. The day he became the number one editor, he called me up and asked to have lunch with me. And when he sat down, he sat, and the first thing he said that came out of his mouth was, George, is there any way you can help me figure out how to do better magazine covers? And I asked him how he produced them now, and he said, well, first we have a meeting of everybody at Esquire after working on an issue, and we decided what article we should do a cover on. I said, yeah. He said, and then we would all, some of us would all come with ideas, and we'd choose four or five, and we would comp them up. At which point I said, oh my God, group fucking grope. He said, what? I said, group grope. Is that the way you work with James Baldwin? Is that the way you work with Norman Mailer? No, of course not. So I said, what you have to do is you have to get somebody who doesn't work at Esquire to take a look at what's an issue. And if there isn't an idea there for one, two, or even three great covers, you got a lousy magazine. And I started to write names of people down that he could possibly work with. And he said, no, wait a minute. And he had a Southern accent, by the way. He was a Southern liberal, which was an oxymoron in those days. And he said, you got to do me a favor, pal. He said, you got to do me one cover. So I said, okay, I'll do your cover. I said, when's the next one due? He said, well, it's due in 4 days, but I'll give you the one for the month after. I said, no, give me the one that's due in 4 days. And he said, really? I said, yeah. I said, well, tell me what's in the issue. He said, well, I have to go back and get all the story. I said, I don't want to read the stories. Tell me what's in the issue. He described, he went, well, there's this and this and this and this and this and this and this. And finally he mentioned, you know, there's going to be a championship fight between Floyd Patterson and Sonny Liston, and then he went on, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, the minute I heard that, I knew I would do a cover of showing Floyd Patterson, who was a 10-to-1 favorite, dead in the middle of a ring, because I knew that Sonny Liston was going to clean his clock. I knew he was going to kill him. So I produced a commercial where I got a boxer who looked like Floyd Patterson, same weight, et cetera, et cetera. We had photograph taken in the middle of an arena. He's laying dead in the middle of a boxing ring, and around him, everybody's left him. He was left for dead. And I sent it to him. The editor thought I was crazy. You're calling the fight. I said, yeah, I'm calling the fight, but you're wrong. Everybody, nobody agrees with you. I said, Harold, trust me, I'm right. And he had the guts to run it. In fact, I found out years later that even though he had just gotten the job, he threatened to quit when the publisher said that you couldn't run it. And he ran it. In fact, when the magazine came out, the publisher wrote in an editor in his publisher's page, you see that cover? We don't agree with it. George Lois, the designer, did that. In any case, when the issue came out, it was a giant hit. It was everybody in America thought it was crazy. Liston was going to be destroyed by Floyd Patterson. And 4 or 5 days later, the fight took place. And Liston knocked out Floyd Patterson. And Esquire was considered a genius publication. And I went on to do them for the covers for Harold for almost the next 10 years.
George Lois there, speaking to Monocle's Tom Edwards. This is a special year-end edition of The Stack with me, Ben Rylan. Still to come, do we still buy the news? We'll put that question to Tyler Brulé and two leading minds from the world of print media. But first, Popeye magazine celebrated its 40th birthday this year. But as Tyler Brulé found when he sat down with Monocle's creative director Richard Spencer Powell and senior strategist Adam Thompson at our sister company upstairs, Wink Creative, the Japanese title still looks as fresh as ever.
The Japanese are incredibly good at repackaging other people's stuff. Now, I would never pick a US city as a place to go to.
Repacking and enhancing it.
And enhancing. Yeah. I would never pick a US city to go to on a shopping trip. Okay, you know, people might love New York. I would choose Tokyo over that. But when you look in these issues of Popeye, they repurpose all of that, you know, varsity, Yale, Ivy League style, and they just sell it back to you in a way that you want to buy it. I would never pick up on it in the States, but when you're in Japan, when you flick through these pages, incredible. And it again, this current issue, the new one, the 40th anniversary one, it's all about LA and California. And again, it's not my first pick of destination, but when you see the amount of stuff that they've uncovered, it just looks like the best place in the world.
Mm-hmm. The issue that the other issue that I bought by is from 1983, and it's entitled Somebody's Trip. And it's great. They just have this kind of like roaming, you know, it's very illustrative, really colourful. But yeah, there's something really wonderful about, you know, this idea of, you know, being on foot and exploring places in such depth and such detail, and they go and meet people, and it's so obviously done with so much love that you can't help but be just like drawn into the whole thing.
Mm. I think it's also amazing because obviously you know, there was a popularity, and there were certainly people who were buying Popeye even in London in the early 1980s, but it wasn't even until the probably late 1990s, early 2000s, that people started jumping on the bandwagon and say, oh, look, you know, Tommy Lee Jones doing like these canned coffee ads and all the different things. But I'm still on the July issue of 1980, and there's David Bowie endorsing I think it's probably a shochu, and it, all the copies in Japanese, but looking fantastic in a satin shirt, and yeah, with this wonderful beverage on the rocks.
Beautiful.
And I think the value of being able to look at something like this. The other thing too is so much discussion today, as you know, particularly this being the Stack, where people talk about, you know, native advertising and the amount of native advertising, which we just call it good old advertorials. And there was a wonderful piece in this issue as well for Suntory, and it's just page after page of great Suntory summer cocktails, but you know, and it's clearly advertising, but brought to you by the Popeye team, mm-hmm. and there to completely tie in with the summer issue as well.
Tyler Brulé with Richard Spencer Powell and Adam Thompson. Now, do we still buy the news? In 2016, the answer to that remained rather mysterious. It was, of course, a year that saw serious journalism sometimes viewed as a nostalgic niche or relegated to the much maligned elite. But if there's any lesson to be learned, it's surely that without good journalism, much of what we take for granted could indeed be lost. Juan Senor is from Innovation Media Consulting, a leading firm specializing in assisting companies transition to the digital age. John Owen is chairman of the Frontline Club and a retired professor of international journalism at City University. He's also formerly the head of CBC Television News, and he was an executive producer at Al Jazeera too. They joined Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, to discuss the delicate balance of proper journalism and good business.
Any business that has been built as the Mail on Sunday on just digital display advertising is extremely vulnerable. That business model is dying quickly. And what's replacing it is native advertising and branded content. But more importantly, what's replacing it is reader revenue. Mm. Getting back to a business model in journalism where we get people to pay for content. And you will not get people to pay for content that the Mail on Sunday produces on a daily basis. So it's not a sustainable model going forward. And basically what's happened is that we have reached the apex of secondhand journalism, charlatanism, and editors that unfortunately they're under tremendous commercial pressures to create these massive audiences that do not get advertisers to pay our bills. And it's a critical moment, but I think there's a realization in the industry that we need to get back to basics, we need to get back to journalism, and we need to move away from volume to value.
John, does this remind you a little bit, if we rewind many, many years ago to the CBC newsroom, even in Toronto, when we had the arrival of 24-hour news, and there was a similar shakeup? What was going to happen to the traditional nightly newscast, this new sort of chase for numbers? Do you think that what we have happening on, let's say, the print newsroom floor has in some ways it already impacted because, that, you know, you would argue, of course, you know, television being an electronic medium, it was already there and has had to sort of fight a similar type of numbers game as well. So when you listen to your print colleagues, do you think there's something similar to what you went through? And okay, albeit CBC is a public service broadcaster, there is still a numbers play there as well.
It does ring very familiar, but I think, again, the point you made is that, you know, it's the journalism. It's still the content that's going to distinguish who makes it and who doesn't. I mean, just look at what the New York Times has done recently. I mean, really imaginative things, virtual reality, this series on the Arab world. I mean, they've reinvented the digital online version of the New York Times with just some of these splashes. So I think it's the journalism. You know, what's going to distinguish the content providers is the journalism itself. But is that really going to be understood? I went to the Global Editors network conference in Vienna. What was on the program the first day? Robotics, game playing. What else was all kinds
virtual
of
virtual reality?
Virtual reality. I mean, that was really the high. They weren't talking about how to find stories.
No, yeah, absolutely. And it's just because is this part of the discussion? Is what, yeah, because oftentimes I'm sure, Juan, you're probably sitting down with people from private equity, all kinds of people who've picked up news groups or newspaper brands for a song. So there has to be a big process of re-education again, no?
Yeah, and fundamentally, the problem is that the news publishing industry suffers from next big thing syndrome. It's like waiting for Godot. And every year is like, oh, now is the Apple Watch. And now is virtual reality. And now is this new platform. Facebook is going to save the day. Mm. And in the process, we are obsessed with innovation of platforms, not innovation of content. And it's only those brands that are focusing on, you know, mastering digital storytelling and then finding people willing to pay for that digital storytelling that will succeed. The rest is just waiting for Godot. We're just waiting for something that's not going to happen. It's not going to come.
You know what's happening beyond everything, both in print and broadcast, and I don't think it's really been taken on board, is virtual streaming. If you looked at the coverage on platforms, what was going on with Munich, what's been going on all over the world, what happened in Turkey, where were people watching it? They were watching it on Periscope. They were watching ordinary people doing the original reporting. Where did Erdogan, how did he communicate with his own people? Facebook Live on streaming. So, I mean, this cuts across all the platforms.
John Owen and Juan Senor with Tyler Brulé. We'll stay on the topic of good journalism now, turning our attention to the role of the Bureau. Stephen Erlanger is the London Bureau Chief for the New York Times and was formerly Chief of the paper's Bureau in Paris and Jerusalem. He's also reported from more than 120 countries, having joined the Times all the way back in 1987. However, as he told Tyler Brulé, many news bureaus today are a far cry from what they once were.
About the metabolism, how the newsroom operation works across, you know, New York to Hong Kong, passing back to London. I just want to go back to bureaus for a moment. And at the start of the show, you were saying the national bureaus are now mostly people working independently. Of course, they're staff members, but they're working from home. But, you know, I can think back to when I came to this city. Bureaus were important for also cutting your teeth as a young journalist, finding your way in the front door, and whether it was making coffee or photocopies, whatever you had to do, that's how you did it. You know, it's great that there's a role sort of elsewhere around the world, but I'm wondering, you know, how does the New York Times, is there a house view when you look at the future of journalists and not people in the business of storytelling, that dreadful word, but people who want to be editors? Is it to bring them into New York? You're going to cut your teeth on the floor there if you're, doesn't matter whether you're from Indiana or Wisconsin. I'm just wondering, what does that sort of uptake of young talent look like today?
Well, it's very interesting because there are a lot of people who, despite the dire economic forecasts everyone has about newspapers, desperately want to come work for us and to be journalists. And, you know, we're very lucky because we get to pick very good people and train them, you know. I mean, I'm very proud of some of the people I've hired as interns and then have brought on and who've either gotten staff jobs with us or elsewhere. I mean, this is something I care about. It's something people help me do, and I feel it a great obligation. But for editors, it's kind of a different route. I mean, The Times is a very heavily edited newspaper. And again, we tend not to take people in their first jobs as editors. We tend to hire people who've already had some experience. And in New York, we tend to put them through quite a difficult copy editing test and so on. Now, this is for copy editors, and then, but when we used to have kind of very much desk-bound editors, there was an editor who really did, for the foreign desk, I remember her name was Jeannie Pinder. She had a tremendous expertise on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. She spoke fluent Russian. She had, you know, she was the style guide of how we transliterated Russian. She was quite fearsome. Now, those sorts of people, we can't really afford that in the same way. There's still people with expertise, but we have a kind of, on a national, foreign copy desk is pretty much put together. We still have story editors on the foreign desk who do have regional expertise. And we have more, you know, continuous news editors who also do some writing. I mean, it is something that is very much in play. But in general, editors tend to first come either from another professional organization or come through the New York training ground. But we're always looking for good copy editors because, you know, we still, to some degree, are the hours are not great. And those people tend to graduate then up to become story editors who are dealing more directly with the first drafts of stories before they then go to the copy desk.
Stephen Erlanger from The New York Times with Tyler Brulé. And finally today, Monocle's Christmas market was again delighting festive shoppers this year with mulled wine, mince pies, and of course a healthy dose of media discussion. With a nosy reindeer peering over his shoulder, Tyler Brulé was joined by Emma Nelson and special guest Jonathan Fenby. He's the former editor of the South China Morning Post and author of the new book, France, A Modern History. They looked at how the news business performed throughout 2016.
Last week we spoke to Sebastian Borger, who's the London correspondent for Der Standard and for the Berliner Zeitung. And when he was on the Saturday weekend edition, he was suggesting perhaps that a newspaper like Die Zeit doesn't have that much of a place anymore. And I was arguing that actually on the contrary, one, you can't eat croissant, bacon roll for breakfast every morning. You occasionally need a little bit of a high-fibre diet, don't you?
Well, also, I was going to say, I mean, interesting that he says that, because Die Zeit is still making money, which is amazing. Well, it's an interesting weekly model.
Yeah. I think Germany is a different case here. Is it that it's a more serious place, generally, or is, you know, that people are willing to spend money, but above all, time? On that, because that's the other question in this, that the old-fashioned broadsheet newspaper model assumed that people had time. Mm. And, you know, when you say, where do they read the paper? It was mainly commuting to work at the moment. But commuting on the tube in London or in Paris or anywhere else, most people are on their mobile phones, not reading newspapers.
It's a 10:15 here in London. You're listening to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé, Emma Nelson, and Jonathan Fenby is with us. Should we, for those people waking up anywhere in the world, should we have a little scan of the paper? I've got The Guardian, and they're leading with a lot of promotion at the top. And I think this is also just interesting. That's about the architecture of the paper. We have we've got a travel guide to Sri Lanka and all sorts of festive treats at the top. I was mean. I just passed Le Monde to Emma.
Well, you've got into politics that. There.
Good job I read it before you came, didn't it? Le Monde has I'm still struggling to work out where Le Monde sits nowadays in the world of newspapers. Yeah. I can't understand why it is how it is at the moment, and Jonathan, I'd be delighted if you could explain later. But the Le Monde weekend has a 14-page special on the battle of the succession of François Hollande. It talks about Hollande's orphans, those who were in his inner circle, who now realise that they have been abandoned by their leader, who has now gone. And if you go further into the paper, it talks about how there has been a drop in unemployment in France, and yet it has come too late, and how some of his followers are now hysterical. Jonathan, please may I ask you what purpose Le Monde serves at the moment? Because it is neither a newspaper of record, it doesn't seem to be a newspaper of speculation, it doesn't have the depth. What is it doing?
It's probably the nearest thing to a newspaper of record, to be fair, that you've got in France, but that may say something about other French newspapers. I mean, I think the trouble with Le Monde, like a lot of other newspapers, a lot of places that I've worked, which is why perhaps I'm glad to be sitting here rather than sitting in a newsroom trying to figure things out, is that what you've had, particularly in Europe, politically and socially, has been the collapse of the old consensus, the old centre, which might be centre-left, might be centre-right. And papers like Le Monde, The Guardian, and so on, lived in that space. And we've had not only the post-truth evolution, but increasingly, you know, people going to extremes, the whole culture wars, etc., spreading to Europe, I think. And papers like Le Monde find it very difficult to find their place in that.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're just joining us, Emma Nelson does not have her belt sander out in the background. We're not in the cozy surrounds of Studio One today. We are indeed outdoor in the courtyard at Midori House. And that is the fine construction happening behind us, just in case you're wondering what's going on. Well, where are the reindeer? That's a bigger question.
Tyler Brulé with Emma Nelson and Jonathan Fenby. And that's it for this week's program. My thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editor, Claire Urban. We're back to our usual format next week. In the meantime, if you have any comments or queries, then drop Fernando a note over at fp@monocle.com. And do remember to subscribe to our podcast as well. And if you fancy picking up any of the titles we've mentioned on the stack, pay us a visit over at the Kiosk Cafe. That's Monocle's very own newsstand in Paddington, here in London. You have been listening to The Stack. I'm Ben Ryland. Have a very happy new year. We'll catch you next week.